It's about that time. And any others coming can always just slide right in. This is Down to the Wire. This is number 10 in the series. And it's kind of hard to believe that it's the last one. Kind of sad that it's the last one. I could go on for another couple of weeks with things like
Stable.
This, I think.
Stable.
I said to Barbara this morning, we ought to consider maybe doing 2 hours a day or a two-hour session or something. I don't know, but maybe it's better this way that, you know, there's always more. Seriously, though, I think you're going to get tired of hearing me say this, but if you're interested in pursuing any more of this stuff, this is probably the best one in the collection. It doesn't have it all, but it also has stuff in that I didn't even touch on, too. So this would be probably the closest one. And of course, they're all sold. They're all gone. But if you really want one, just swing by here, and I've got a sheet. Just leave your $5, and we'll mail you one, if you'd like. Finding balance in a world of extremes, and today, well, I guess I have to say that we can roll a tape. We're on. This is the 10th in the series of Finding Balance in a World of Extremes. My name is Bill Miller, and the subject of our continuum today is galoshes, umbrellas, and motorcycle helmets. And just one more time, let me remind you that what this is about is trying to realize that very often in our lives we live close to or in the extremes of various dimensions of life. And over the 2 weeks we've been together, I've been talking about, well, today the 10th one, the 10th dimension or the 10th facet of life, and this one having to do with risk-taking. And I'll show you my cards right up front. The bulk of the people that I have dealt with shake out much, much more over on this end rather than on the other end of being wild, reckless actors out of impulsive things. So I can tell you right from the beginning that my bias is going to be to encourage you to move towards the midpoint or the mid-path of healthy risk-taking. This is a discuss as you go tour.
I made it.
2 out of 10. How about that? 20%. Well, see, nobody's perfect. Remember the imperfect achiever? All right.
You're getting balanced.
I'm getting balanced. Thank you, Doris. Essentially, what we have over here are people who, in this kind of the vernacular, are everlastingly playing it safe, no matter what. I don't want a chance. I'm afraid that I'll fail, that I'll lose. You got to take precautions. You can't be too careful in this life. The Mark Twain quote is that classic one where in the older years he said, "I am an old man and I have experienced many calamities, most of which never happened to me." Fret and worry and worry and fret. I know lots of people who are professional worriers. You can pay them to worry for you. They'll be glad to do it. In fact, they'll worry for you without pay. But then over on the other extreme is the concept of just foolhardiness and irresponsibility. Just taking up dangerous chances. We do that when we're kids. One of the, I can hardly believe that I did this as a boy, but we had lots of train tracks around Pittsburgh. And near Esplanade, where I lived, there were trains in front and trains in the back. And the trains in the back, there was a footbridge up over from Esplanade up to Sheridan. And we kids used to stand on the outside of that footbridge and jump onto moving freights. Just for the thrill of it. Just for the risk of it. And you always jump, you see. But actually, it wasn't totally impulsive. You would jump between boxcars so that you would be sure to hit the top of a boxcar. Then, of course, you have to get your balance and kind of fall down and grab hold of the top of it. We also used to jump from, you know, those big steel high-tension towers. I told you the other day I don't have any cartilage left in this knee. That's the reason why. I didn't realize that at the time. But the trick there was the higher you could jump from, the more macho you were. And, of course, as you hit the ground, you had to spread your legs or else your chin would come down and you'd mash your teeth on your knees.
And so the impact on the knees, we were really risk takers. There's no question about it, but that's crazy. We thought we would live forever. Kids do that, you know. Kids think they'll live forever, so why sweat it? Why fret? Why worry?
Yeah. Have you heard about the Brazilian train surfers? The kids that kill themselves by jumping on the trains and they stay on them. And the idea is to see how close you get to the poles or can you clear the bridges and all that stuff. Oh, and they often get killed or crippled.
It's a serious situation. And it's the very poor kids that can't afford the surfboards.
My.
And it's really become a culture, and it's an addictive behavior. Once they start doing it, they can't stop it.
Mm-hmm. Instead of jumping on top, they grab the side and kind of just hang on to
We used to do that too. It's called hopping freights. But it was just a matter of hopping. And what you do is you just have to run alongside of it, you know, as fast as the train is going. Which kids were fast, and you grab the ladder and swing up. In our case, though, to the best of my knowledge, we never lost one kid like that. Mm-hmm. Or nobody ever got hurt. But at any rate, there's certainly a lot to be said for playing it safe. There's no question about that. For taking precautions and for really being conservative as you walk through life. But let me tell you something that I discovered and some other researchers had discovered, unbeknownst to me. In the process of dealing with people moving into the later years of life, and I define that as 65, 70, somewhere on there and on up, I discovered, because I started asking people, like, if you had it to do over, what would you do differently? And a very, very common theme, and I mentioned this if any of you were here last week, the commonest statement, the most common statement was, I wish I had taken more risks. I did not take enough risks. Now they say this, people say this retrospectively, mind you, with the 2020 vision of looking back, of saying, boy, back there in 1942, if I had so-and-so, it would have been a lot different. Or, I don't know, I had an opportunity when I was in seminary, I had to decide whether to go theater or to go pulpit. You know, I chose to go pulpit instead of theater. I don't know if I ever would have made it on stage or not. But I really loved acting and directing, but who can say? That's a common theme that people, and what that will look back and say, I wish I hadn't played it quite as safe as I did. And that's what leads me to reinforce my observation that most people shake out over on this end. Maybe not most, but certainly more than those that shake out on the other end. Incidentally, the second thing that they say, there are three things that are common threads that run through their responses. The second thing is, I wish I had been more assertive. I was not assertive enough. I did not assert myself enough. And the third thing is, I did not practice enough self-discipline. I just kind of cruised through. And that's really what people who are in the galoshes and umbrellas side do. And then say, kind of winsomely, plaintively, life has sort of passed me by. And it's a degree of sadness to it. Melancholy when they say that. Well, sure, you wear galoshes in the snow, absolutely. And you take an umbrella when it's raining outside, and you do wear a helmet when you ride a motorcycle. But to experience the parasos that we've been talking about, that super abundance of life that Jesus said he came that we might have, you risk appropriately all along the path of life. And so as a wrap-up to this series, I think I have saved the best for last, at least as far as I'm concerned. I want to talk with you today about risk-taking, the willingness to risk, about the value of failure, and about the excitement of creativity, those three that I believe bring us to a healthy risk midpoint. The willingness to risk, part one. This is a tricky word, risk. Risk is a very tricky word. It falls into the category of words like crisis and conflict. They're all neutral words. They can go either way. And our society has chosen to hang on to the negative connotations of it. Conflict can be a very positive thing. Conflict can be a very destructive thing. Crisis. Crisis is simply a turning point. A turning point for the better or a turning point for the worse. And I say we've decided in our culture to hook on to the negative dimension or connotation of these words. And so we look at risk and say, oh, no, no, not good, not good at all. I made a collection of the negative images that are sort of colloquialisms for risk and see if any of them sound familiar to you. Go out on a limb. Tempt Providence. Sleep on a volcano. Dance on the razor's edge. Carry, if you sailors, carry too much sail. You know what that means. You capsize. Lay oneself open to, speaks to vulnerability. Take one's life in one's hand. And so I need to try to help us look for a new view of risk. And I would like us to see it more as a matter of choice. Seeing that risking actually equals choosing, and choosing actually equals risking, really, no matter what is involved. Because in risk, we are always faced with a decision either to choose the status quo or to choose change. Now, some people are going to say that choosing the status quo is not really choosing at all, but in fact, it is. Even choosing not to choose is a choice. And that, in fact, turns out to be the greatest of all risks, I think. The greatest of all risks is not to risk. That is to literally step out of the parade of life, out of the process of life. Sometimes I've run into this with people who, after retirement, kind of draw the shades and close the door and sort of turn out the lights. Because after all, what else is there? You know, we've got it all. We've done it all, but we really haven't done it all. And we really haven't got it all. To not risk is to sit out life. To be forever outside, not even in the bleachers watching it, but outside. Maybe you can find a knot hole here and there to see the game, but that's about the size of it. The image I have is just to hop on the wagon when the wagon is going by and not really know where the wagon is going. Rather than to mount up on the wagon, take the reins in your hand, and drive the horse. That's risk. The truth of it is, and I kid you not about this, and I'm sure you can identify with at least part of it, all of life is a series of risks. We simply cannot mature without taking risks. We have a lot of little kids around the village this week who are learning to walk. And it's delightful to see them fall down. I mean, not in a sick sense, but I mean, it is. You know, they go down so gracefully, and they come right back up. But they don't know that they're risking, but they are risking. They could choose to stay right there on the ground and have somebody pick them up. And probably somebody would pick them up, but they'd never learn to walk. We really wouldn't learn anything in life if we didn't take the chance of it.
We wouldn't have children either.
Yeah, absolutely. The race would die out.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Now, we may agree with that, all right, and say, yeah, what you're saying, what we're all saying is absolutely true, but we still have to face always what appears to be the reasonableness, see, of everlastingly playing it safe. Because there's a lot of good reasons for that. We don't want to get hurt. We get to a branch in the road where one path goes into change and another path goes into status quo, and we say, oh, well, gee whiz, you know, I risked 5 years ago and didn't work out all that swift, so I think I'm going to stay on the status quo road. And we can always find a whole host of reasons, always, good. good reasons, which are of course only rationalizations, but nevertheless they are good reasons to play it safe. And rationalization comes into our head, and there's sort of an inner voice that says, are you sure you want to do this? Are you sure it is worth it? Watch out. Be careful, girl. Play it safe, boy. Fact is, there is no absolute security in this life. We live on faith and hope. End of sentence, end of paragraph, end of book. That's it. Of course, we do as much as we possibly can, as much as is reasonable, to provide for our safety and security. We don't go up the mountain over sharp rocks in our bare feet. We put on hiking shoes. Makes sense. It is stupid to go up the mountain on sharp rocks in your bare feet. But in the end, there is absolutely no guarantee that all of our efforts will have made any difference at all. Now, that's not pessimism or nihilism or defeatism. That is simply reality. We may know people who have played it safe all the way down the line, been ultra-conservative, only to have some catastrophe, some tragedy come in and wipe everything. That's tragic, of course, but there is no guarantee. Jesus never guaranteed it. Lots of people think that once you throw in your lot with the Christ, you're immune from all sorts of things. I run into that problem with people who are distressed with Christians who have emotional breakdowns. Who say, well, you know, if you're really a Christian, you will never break down. I'm sorry, but that's not quite right. Jesus never said, follow me and you'll never crack up. No, you have to, yes.
So does risk kind of stop just this side of stupidity?
It depends. It's very, very relative. And I think as I give you, I've got a whole bunch of illustrations and stories and myths and tales to tell you this morning. And maybe those will help you. The very first one is a one that I came across. I like to read myths, mythology, and fairy tales and nursery rhymes because they are so alive with good truth. A lot of good Christian theology in them too, even though you know you have to sort of scrounge around for it. But one of my favorites is titled "The Beginning." The whole thing is titled "The King and the Corpse," and I came upon it in a book done by Heinrich Zimmer, who unfortunately died much before he should have, but who was a collector, an anthologist, a collector of tales. And this one, The King and the Corpse, the beginning of it is a setting, just to kind of get the thing going, of a king. Once upon a time there was a king who every morning would review whatever situations needed to be reviewed in the kingdom, minor squabbles, kind of like what's the court? Small claims court, that sort of thing. And every morning, there would be a mendicant, a beggar, who would come to him, walk up to the throne in an appropriate way when his turn came, and hand the king a piece of overripe fruit. The king would take it, the mendicant would turn around and walk away, and never one word passed between them. The king, wishing to be a gracious sort, would always hand it over to the treasurer. And the treasurer would kind of casually, when no one was looking, there was a little window in the wall, a little hole in the wall up above the king's throne, would just kind of shoot it up there. You know, that would be the end of that. This went on for like 10 years. 10 years, mind you. Until one day, the same thing happens. The mendicant comes up and he hands the king a piece of overripe fruit. But the king's monkey has escaped from the cage, and the king's monkey has been running around the court. Nobody is paying much attention to him. He's doing silly monkey things, and monkeys do. And as the king is about to pass it over, the overripe fruit, to the treasurer, the monkey grabs it and starts juggling around and messing with it. and suddenly drops it and it splats on the floor of the throne, and here in the middle of it is a ruby the size of your thumb. And the king looks at the treasurer, and the treasurer looks at the king, and the king says, old treasurer, what have you been doing with this rotten fruit all these years? And the treasurer said, I've been throwing it up through the hole in that water. And they, both of them immediately tear around to the other side in this room, which is really like a sealed off wall, and they knock a hole into it. And here, amidst all kinds of putrid fruit in varying degrees of rottenness, is a literal pile of gems. Now you say, but how is he to know? How is he to know that inside something that appeared to be even blech, there was something of great value? Well, how was he to know? How is anybody to know? How is any one of us to know? Unless we take a look into it. How many times every day of our lives, does somebody hand us a piece of rotten fruit, so to speak, symbolically? And we go, oh, yuck. Or we throw it away, without ever giving any thought that there might just be something of real worth and value in there, if we would take the risk of breaking it open, or biting into it, or getting past the putridness of it. How many gems have we thrown away? I'm not trying to guilt us. God forbid, I don't have to do that. We've got enough guilt as it is. I'm just trying to say, I think this is a marvelous, marvelous illustration. See, it's the monkey who discovers it. It's the doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo. It's not the finger. Well, now let's see. There may be rain this afternoon, so I'll wear my galoshes. Or I'll break the umbrella along. It's the monkey who discovers it. It's the person. The monkey risks all the time. Monkey didn't know what risk is. They're playing it safe. Monkey is just a monkey. Well, maybe we could become monkeys then.
Again, I think oftentimes kids are the ones that hand us this rotten fruit,
right.
And they might be the monkey.
Right, mm-hmm. Exactly. It's the point is, you just never know. You don't know. How was the king to know? He couldn't possibly. I have a consolatum I've seen for a number of years, an attorney, a woman, whose life has been quite unfulfilled for her, and she is a person who has big dreams. I mentioned that the other day. A big dream is a dream that has some symbolic significance and meaning. And she shares them with me all the time. We work with them, and they keep hammering away. Her unconscious keeps hammering away at risk-taking, and she keeps pulling back and saying, no, even though the sun is shining, it'll rain in 10 minutes, so I'll carry my umbrella. The one dream, it has to do with rain, in fact. She is in a big house, and a house is pretty generally symbolic of the self. And so we know right at the beginning that she is within her own self, and it's raining outside, and pouring down rain, and the sky is black, and she knows that she wants to go outside. She has something that she needs to do. She's not sure what it is. That's not important. But she hesitates going outside because it is so, the weather is so inclement. But she screws her courage to the sticking point, goes out the door, and as soon as she gets off the porch, the rain stops and the sun comes up. Isn't that something? And here is her inner self, her inner woman saying, take the risk. Take the chance. How do you know that the rain is going to keep pouring down on you? Maybe the rain poured down on you once before in your life. That doesn't mean it's going to pour down on you now. Another one she had was, she's in the house again, so we know that she's within herself. And a man comes to the door carrying 7 dresses. And again, in dreams, there's a lot of symbolic stuff. Nothing is ever really, really sharply clear. All she knows is that he is offering them to her. Whether he's selling them or giving them, she doesn't know. But she tries them all on. They all fit, and they are all very attractive.
Now, you don't have to be a Carl Jung or a Sigmund Freud to get that one either. You know, dress, your clothing, part of the persona, the outer self, symbolic of all the possibilities that she has, should she ever decide to put on something other than the barrister's robes, so to speak. Profound, absolutely profound. But she's not quite ready yet. I don't want to chance it. Thank you. And that's where she is. We do not foolhardily risk, we don't do spur of the moment impulsive actions. We think out our risk taking. I would never suggest to this woman as her counselor or therapist, well, just quit your job and run off and do something. Can't do that. That's over here. That's the impulsive acting out. I know some people do that, no question about that. But that's not healthy risk taking. Like yesterday, or not yesterday, the day before, we were talking about the establishment of goals. We sit down and plot these things out, realizing there are going to be trade-offs. And there's going to have to be some delayed gratification. But nevertheless, that's to get on the wagon and take up the reins, rather than watching one wagon after another go by and then in the end saying, life has just passed me by. And we have the freedom to risk. We have the freedom to risk all the way through. I continually keep needling elderly people. They want to say to me, hey, the train has already left the depot, Miller. And I say, you're right. The train, lots of trains have already left the depot, and you missed them, right? However, there is a train running every hour on the hour, and you can get on it. Let me share with you a couple of the examples, some of which you may know. Harlan Sanders, who was, Colonel Sanders of Kentucky Fried Chicken, only began to franchise his chicken recipe when he was 66 years old. And Harriet Dorr, who wrote her first novel, Stones for Ibarra, was 74 years old when she wrote it, and in 1984 she received the American Book Award for it. And how many of you know Anna Mary Robertson Moses? You remember Grandma Moses? Never touched a paintbrush, even, until she was in her late 70s. And she continued to be a popular artist until her death in 1961 at age 101. Well, you could say, and again, rationalization will come in and say, well, that was okay for them, but not for me. Let me stop and see if anything you want to check out about the willingness to risk, because I'm moving to failure now, I know.
Well, Bruce Larson, you probably have read enough about him. He's the Robert Schuller of the Presbyterian Church by writing books. Anyway, he took 2 or 3 years off, sabbatical, and he studied risk. And he came out with the conclusion that it's the best way to avoid mental illness is to take healthy risks.
Really?
You might want to read some of his material.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can imagine that, even without giving it much thought, because there's a lot of stress that is generated by the internal struggle. And they're constantly saying no to your inner voice, which says, take a chance.
Well, it's the whole difference between being on the offensive versus being on the defensive.
Article that I have no idea the author of the source, but a comment that caught me by surprise, but I've since thought about it in relation to what you're talking about. The ceasing to be willing to take risk at all is the beginning of death.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
And actually, as you start with youth and go to old age, don't you start on one side and just progress to the other side?
Yeah.
Isn't that
right? Okay,
Well, we live in a small rural area that's a mill town, and one of the things that I see is people who spend 35 years working in the mill. And the mill that I worked in sold after I'd been there for 13 years, and that was the best thing that could have happened, in spite of the fact the initial was, my gosh, who's going to take care of me? Because they do take care of you. But when you have second and third generation people who never have gotten out of anything else, and the bell rings almost like up here. Not quite, but that wasn't that long ago, where even the environment that was here when the house sound mind had it, a very close knit, don't take any risk. The mill will take care of you. Your check comes every 2 weeks. They will bury you, and they will take care of your medical needs and everything else for you. Have no fear.
It's true. Tragic, but nevertheless true. Well, I had a little time to get into failure on Thursday, and so I thought we need to look at that, because that is very, very definitely a dimension of this. The fear of failure is absolutely critical and will cause us all kinds of anguish, just the fear of failing. When I was doing the research for this Golden Shadow book, I came across a book that was titled Taking Chances, The Psychology of Losing and How to Profit from It, written by a fellow named Robert Lewis. And he had what caught my eye was that chapter 14 of the book was titled The Myth of Perfection. And I read through it, and it was a library copy at the Hennepin County Library in Minneapolis. And when I got to the last page, it was like a half page, and somebody had scrawled in capital letters, and I remember that the lines ran down a bit, at the end of this, "Be ye perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect." They'd written that in pencil. It's Matthew 5:48. And I could not help. I literally laughed right there in the library. I couldn't help but laugh, because I thought, here is somebody who read this guy's book, and they got to this chapter called The Myth of Perfection. And by George, they were going to straighten him out, and they were going to straighten out everybody who read that chapter. But the irony of it, the real irony of it, is that word, and I mentioned it to somebody, I don't remember if it was in this group or not, that word in Matthew is teleos. In the Greek, it looks like this. And it can be translated perfection. We got into it by the King James translators back in 1611. They chose that because I guess it seemed to make more sense, and so everybody traditionally perceives it as moral perfection, which it really isn't at all. The word is one of those words, again, that you have to transliterate. You really can't find one word to match it. But it has to do with the process of coming to completion. And the best word that we would have now in our psychological/theological sense would be what we call wholeness. Wholeness and completeness. And so essentially what Jesus says, and he says it, you see, right in the middle of the Sermon on the Mount or the plain or wherever it was that he did it. In order to do this, to get this way of life across, you know, that you love your enemies and you do good to those that despise you, and if somebody takes your overcoat, you offer him your undercoat, and so on. In order to live this way, you really have to be an integrated person. And this, again, is what we've been talking about here in these 2 weeks, the sense of balance. And so the irony of this person writing in the book is he or she is actually reinforcing what the author is saying. Be whole and complete. Wholeness and completeness includes imperfection. It includes failure, because failure is a given. Failure is a significant and important part of life. I also came across a book, and I have conveniently blocked out the author and the title, that described a system of education, and possibly some of you teachers and educators are familiar with this. It turned me off, and so I didn't remember much about it, other than that it is a system of education wherein the child/student cannot fail. Failure is impossible. Do you know what that is?
Schools Without Failure by William Glasser.
Bill Glasser? Oh, I can't believe you would do a thing like that. Well, that's terrible. I'm really sorry. Maybe that was why I buried it, because I didn't want to think of Bill Glasser or anything like that. That's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. Not to ever have the experience of feeling, we don't live in a greenhouse world. I mean, you get to the end of your education, what do then? There's probably a lot more to it than meets the eye, but just the very concept of protecting a person from failure seems to me to be a very dangerous kind of thing. Are you sure that's right?
No, I think he meant the opposite in the book.
Hey, what about
your analogy about the child falling? He's saying that schools must allow him. That's how we learn.
Oh, then that wasn't what I came across. Then my source was different. Is that what Glasser said?
I don't think that's the message of the book.
Oh. Well, whatever. Let me make my witness here that if we as parents disallow our kids to fail, they're never, ever going to make it. They're just not going to make it. The place of success and failure in our society has gotten so out of whack. Failure has gotten such rotten press that success is indeed a god or goddess. Success is idolized. People, in order to succeed, and you know this as well as I, will cheat and steal. Look at all of the cheating that goes on, not only in high school, but graduate school, postgraduate school, medical schools, cheating just to succeed. People will sell their family down the river just to succeed and not fail. Yes?
As a teacher, I see a real increased tendency for parents to rescue their children and not allow them to fail a course or not get the paper in. They will go to great lengths to rescue them.
Yeah.
And more and more I see that, so it kind of goes along with what you're saying.
When the young people, the teenagers, were speaking to the forum to us in the forum last week, they were saying, speaking about the pressure and stress that young people are under, namely to succeed, not to fail. And it just escalates more and more, it seems, with each passing generation. I know that there are notable exceptions to this broad, sweeping generalization, but my observation, generally speaking, is that that's it, that success, how to succeed. How many books? Look up Succeed or Success in your library and see how many books there are on how to succeed, even by, you know, how to dress to succeed. Does somebody have something over here?
Well, I was just going to say, as a teacher, I'd like to say a word in defense of the reform that I see happening now, that the word that you're using is success, is we're trying to refocus, and I would say Glasser is pointing that way too, that we're not looking at success as opposed to failure, we're looking at competence. The people, looking at building in that self-confidence that you talk about as being so basic, that these children see themselves as competent learners, competent people that are able to handle success and failure and live in a world of cooperation rather than a world of competition where we are. In the past, we have traditionally been extremely competitive in the school system.
Yeah.
And the reform that's happening now, we hope, is looking at helping these children learn that they are capable and that they are can work together rather than
failure really is not a scientific, generally speaking, not a scientific matter. It is generally a very subjective thing, very arbitrary. Now, of course, there are certain things that are relatively absolute. When we had a bridge structure collapse and a new bridge was being built over there in Minneapolis, the superstructure failed. There's no question about that. I mean, that is a scientific fact. But very, very often, in the majority of cases, failure is a very relative thing. Some people can look at the issue and say it was success. Other people look at exactly the same issue and say that it was failure. again, it depends upon from whence you come. And that so often is the case in what you're talking about. Very, very relative. One parent can, two kids can have exactly the same performance, and one parent will say, you failed, and another parent will say to his kid or her kid, you succeeded. I have an illustration that points that out. I got this years ago when the Cold War was really full tilt. A Russian and an American ran a race. The American was the first to cross the finish line and so won the race. Okay. Following the victory, an American newspaper heralded the result with a headline that read, American wins race. Russian finishes last. Now, that's accurate, right? American wins race, Russian finishes last. The Russian newspaper headline proclaimed, Russian places second in race, American is next to last. Pretty tricky, huh? Pretty tricky, I tell you. I want to give you two profound. Well, no. Before I do, I do have to say that any of you who are of any kind of a scientific orientation, kind of giggle a little bit at all the talk about failure, because any kind of scientific experimentation is just replete with failure. I mean, how many times do we fail in the laboratory over and over and over and over and over until we hit it and hit it right? And how many times do inventors fail over and over and over and over and over until they get it right and it works? Thank God for failure. But I've got a couple really profound stories, at least I think they're profound, to point out the value, the hidden benefits, the real worth, if you will, of failure. When Bell completed the telephone successfully and had the thing working, Edison got to thinking that this is going to be an expensive kind of deal. And so he got the notion that he should have some kind of a device that would allow sort of a post office effect at the ends of telephone circuitry. So that, let's just say, for instance, there was a telephone line from Spokane to Chelan. And Edison is thinking it's going to be awfully expensive for everybody in Chelan and Spokane to have telephones. So his idea was that the end lines would be sort of like post offices, and he would invent something that you could keep the message, sort of like sending a letter, only in words. And that's how he got into inventing the recording machine, which ultimately became the Victrola, and ultimately into the whole system that we know of voice reproduction. Well, his invention never amounted to anything, because actually it wasn't that great of an idea. You know, people wouldn't go to the Chelan telephone to say, are there any messages for me today? And then have to try to find it on the spool. It just didn't go. So it was a total and complete failure. Total and complete failure, but it was the granddaddy, the grandmama of the whole recording industry. Imagine that. And many of you are familiar with Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing, 3M. I really love this story. A few years back, and I first picked this up in the Wall Street Journal as a lead article on the front page, so you can gather there was some real substance to it. For a while, 3M actually produced brassieres. Did you know that? The 3M was into the brassiere business? The reason why it's a rare person. Let me just see, did anybody ever know that, first of all? One person did. The reason why it's such rare knowledge is that their first order was their last order. They only had one, and it just didn't go. Because they may have been marvelous scientists as far as developing the fabric, but they must have been lousy engineers in terms of developing the instrument itself. So it was a complete bust.
You tell that just so you can give us yeah.
No, that's what went around 3M over there, actually.
Yeah, sure.
And so you would say, well, chuck that and throw everything out. But they didn't chuck that. Well, the scientists went to work because they knew they had something here in this fabric. But what are you going to do with it? And through a variety of more experiments and concomitant failures, they settled on an awareness that it was a marvelous filter. And so they shaped it into a dust mask. And that's how 3M's industrial masks came about. You can go to the store and buy, they're expensive. You can go to the store and buy them now. So then the motto was, from bust to dust.
I believe that also went that it went further for their cold weather masks.
Yes, yeah.
And indeed right. Their surgical masks.
It's gotten into a multi-million dollar. I think they still operate out of the industrial division, if I remember right. That's busted. We're on a roll. Let's go for it.
We're talking about creativity now.
Let's go for creativity. Anything more about failure before we move into creativity? Yeah.
Well, the same thing with 3M. They had created a glue, and it wasn't sticking. The adhesive was bad, and the post-it notes.
Right. Yeah. That's one of the most famous. But I don't think that the Brazier story is well known at all, obviously. I just really love that. Anything else about failure? Creativity requires something that we in America are not prone to be comfortable with. Creativity requires a whole new way of thinking. It requires us to free ourselves from the bonds, the chains of rationality. And then as soon as I say that, people are going to say, oh, wow, now nobody's really over the edge. I just dip and glue again. Of course we need rationality. There's no question about that. If we didn't have rationality, life would be absolutely chaotic, anarchic. We wouldn't make it. But when we contemplate creativity, we move into a whole different atmosphere, a completely different atmosphere, wherein the irrational is the desirable, even the essential norm. People who stick alone to rationality are bound to them. And only when you break those only when you break those bonds are you free to become creative. Creativity suggests that, at least for a time, we abandon common sense. And now here, some of you may remember that just a few days ago, I said common sense is one of the most gracious gifts of God. And now here I am saying that if you're going to be creative, you've got to throw it out the window and get rid of common sense. You know why? Because common sense will keep you right smack with both feet on the earth. It'll keep you standing there watching in early morning the sun come up over in the east. And you'll stand there if you wish to, perhaps in the shade if you are smart. Watch it, and at high noon it'll be right overhead. And then if you don't grow weary of doing this, pretty soon you will see it go down over the mountains over there in the west. And common sense will tell you, obviously, you have not moved one iota all day long, but that thing has moved. Therefore, we're fixed, and that thing is moving. and common sense told that to humankind for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And as soon as someone suggested that maybe that wasn't right, they told him he was nuts. Just go up to the shop and get a piece of galvanized tin, like they use for the squirrel things around the bird feeders, and throw it up in the air and watch what happens. Common sense tells you that's so much heavier than air, it's going to crash right down to the ground. Therefore, common sense would tell you never, ever try to build a machine out of metal that weighs thousands of tons and expect it to fly. Or go get yourself a 55-gallon drum, fill it up with water, drop a cement block in it and see what happens. You say, you fool, it'll go right to the bottom. Well, of course it'll go right to the bottom. Common sense tells you that it's heavier than water, it'll go right to the bottom. Therefore, common sense would tell you never, ever to fashion a boat hull out of cement. But common sense isn't always right. And common sense will indeed be shackles to any one of us who wants to move into the realm of creativity. Now, don't hear me say abandon common sense. I didn't say that. All I'm saying is that anytime you want to move into the realm of creativity, take some risks, chance it, possibly fail, and in that process, move into the realm of healthy risk, the midpoint between this everlastingly playing it safe and the other extreme of just wildly and impulsively acting it out. We'll never get there if we hang on to common sense. We have to let it go and move then into the sort of nether world of possibility. Possibility. People get on to Shore because of his possibility thinking. I don't get on to Shore because of his possibility thinking. He's not a dummy. He knows that if you're going to build a crystal cathedral, you can't stay with common sense. You've got to get beyond that. We actually move out of the realm of facts. We move into the near factual. Now, it's a fact, at least according to what we understand right now, that 2 plus 2 is 4. That's a fact. At least as best we can explain it. A near truth is the equation wealth equals power. I would not say that was a fact. That's something you can mess around with. That's not a truth. That is a near truth. Maybe a truth, maybe not a truth. And that's the sort of thing that we need to move into. To move into the possibility thinking. The biggest torpedo into any kind of creativity is it will never work. Oh, that will never work. Once those words are uttered, forget it. It's gone. There's no chance of creativity. All this, of course, is easier said than done. I mean, that's something else. Because in our society, we have been taught from early on that the intellectual, the rational, the reasoning self should indeed dominate, and that's what should be developed. We very, very rarely go outside rationality to be creative in the whole process, our whole educational, and you who are educators, correct me if I'm wrong, but generally speaking, by and large, we do not encourage students to move outside the realm of rationality into the irrational. In fact, some of our school systems have even cut out art. One of the tragedies of growing up in America is that amongst all these extroverts, which most of us turn out to be because that's the way our culture goes, the introverted types, who are oftentimes the very creative ones because they use their intuitive dimension, get clobbered to death early on in life. Two extroverted parents who happen to be blessed with an introverted child. Extroversion simply is to use your psychic energy outward, to dispel it, to dispense it that way. Introversion is to use that psychic energy to bring it inward.
And I wrote up a fantasy story that's in Golden Shadow about how mom comes in and finds young Charlie, who's about 8 or 9, just sitting in his room, and she says, "What are you doing?" And he says, "I'm contemplating." And she says, "You're what?" He says, "I'm just sitting here thinking." "Well, what are you thinking about?" "Well, nothing in particular. But look at the sun, it is so bright and shiny, the air is great, the humidity is low, why don't you go outside and play?" "I don't want to." "Why not?" "Because I want to sit here and contemplate." "Let me feel your head, are you all right? You feel okay? You got a fever?" I'm fine." "Well, your brother Billy's out there working on a model airplane, why don't you go out and help him?" "I don't want to go out and help him." What is wrong? There's nothing. There's got to be something wrong with you. I mean, no healthy, red-blooded American, especially boy, is going to sit in his room looking at the floor contemplating. So whenever the other parent gets home, this parent is going to say, "You know, I think we got a problem with..." What did I call him for now?
Charlie.
Probably Charlie. We better take him to the doc. He's got one of those viruses that you can't detect or whatever. And that's humorous on the one hand, but it's tragic on the other hand. That we are not allowing, you know, simply don't allow ourselves to unprogram the programming that our culture and society almost automatically creates. You know, get out here, get out, go on the floor, go out and dance. I don't want to dance. Okay. Is there anything afoot, maybe in some kind of special education systems that I'm not aware of, but the educational systems that I am aware of are very, very head-oriented. And no one... Let me just do a quick poll of you as a fairly sizable audience. Was there ever in your growing up process any significant encouragement to kind of waste time contemplating how a wheel turns on a bicycle or whatever, or just you know, watching a caterpillar crawl up a twig? Was there ever any encouragement to get outside of the rational boundaries? Or was there stronger encouragement perhaps to do something creative, something that will earn you some money? Good grief, you know, poets and guitar players are always hungry and broke. You don't want to do that. Get into computer programming. Yes.
Yeah, I had it happen, but it wasn't in school. It was more by observation. My dad got his degree in forestry, and I liked the woods. And we would go out into the woods, and sometime in my life, I observed that yes, he had learned the names of trees and things, but he had gone beyond that. There was a sense of community, or almost relationship with the environment, that I couldn't define, but I could see it. Mm-hmm. And so there was... It was in that sense that there was something beyond what I was able to realize.
That's good. See, what happens is we get into our intuitive function. Our intuitive function, which is that dimension of ourselves that allows us to see around corners, allows us to see what is not yet there. That is real creativity, and that comes out of our intuitive sense. And we need that nourished, we need that stroked. But that's sort of the scary area. And we don't often like to get into that because, you know, when you start talking about seeing the handwriting on the wall or whatever, that's outside the realm of rationality. And of course, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Well, somehow to be creative, we have to find a way to play our hunches, to take our risks. Well, to find that desirable mid-path of healthy risk-taking between foolish and dangerous chance, we do take our risks, not fearing failure, knowing that failure is an integral part of life, and that to find any sense of this richness and fullness, we are going to have to move in that direction. You who were familiar with Rodgers and Hammerstein's South Pacific, remember that very poignant song called Happy Talk that Bloody Mary sings about her daughter and the lieutenant when she says, "You gotta have a dream. If you don't have a dream, how you gonna have a dream come true?" And that's right. You've got to have a dream. That's one of the things that I was leading up to on Thursday, talking about the establishment of setting goals. Let yourself dream dreams. Of course you have to have one foot on the ground, but that doesn't mean you can't have your head in the clouds, do you? Dreaming dreams and thinking of possibilities. You've got to have a dream. Else, how are you ever going to have a dream come true? And don't worry about how crazy it seems. Take a risk. Chance it. Go for it. Well, this has been a very exciting series for me to present, and I really hope that in some way it's been helpful to you with so graciously participated in it with your presence and your conversation. Remember this whole business of seeking balance that we've been about these 2 weeks is so that we might experience this kairosos, this abundant life, the abundance of life. And so I thought I simply have to close by wishing you all a Holden Village ice cream cone or a Holden Village sundae, one that is just flopping over the sides of the cone or dripping over the sides of the dish. I don't think I could wish you a better wish than that for each of you. God bless you all forever.